This afternoon I'm here with Jeff Martin of Martin Survival in Joshua Tree, and we're at Dirt Time 2014 high in the hills above Beaumont, California. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Christopher.
Yeah, good. How was your drive out to Dirt Time this time?
It was safe.
That's good. That's the way we want it to be. Yeah. Now, for those of you who don't know, you've probably you can go onto YouTube and you could see short videos that Jeff makes about different training activities in his school. So why don't we begin by you just telling us about first how you got into a lot of the survival and primitive skills, and we'll go from there.
Sure thing. Thank you. So I first started outdoor skills as a young child. I learned the ways of the land through my grandfather, my grandmother, and my father. We used to scout and hunt for deer. We used to hunt geese, hunt duck.
Did you grow up in the Joshua Tree area?
Yes, yeah, yeah. I was originally born in Moreno Valley, and then we moved out to the Morongo Basin in Joshua Tree. And I just, you know, scouted, did a lot of hands-on experience. My grandmother, she survived the Great Depression, and I'll never forget some of the stories of my grandmother learning from the Indian people up in Saskatchewan and in the farm country. And one of the stories was when she was a young child, what they would have to do is they would have to weave yucca baskets to carry their school books as a backpack. So she kind of taught me early on different plants and different wildlife and how to farm and cultivate. Same thing with my father, how to hunt, scout, track. And we had one of my childhood friends and my father's friend, his name was Larry, and he was a former park ranger and former LAPD officer, and he taught me a lot about the land too. He taught me how to shoot a traditional arrow and how to shoot a traditional bow and shoot a compound bow. But I really didn't develop a strong interest in primitive technology until about 5 years ago.
And let's define primitive versus modern, at least how you define it.
Yeah, I define primitive technology by what the environment has to provide. So, for example, we make an atlatl or a bow. We go out, we gather natural materials, we gather everything our Creator has to provide, including stone tools, and we craft different items that the ancient Indians in California and throughout the world used to use. So that's how I would define primitive technology.
So in other words, something that you didn't buy from the store. And in the early days, I presume you did just use store-bought bows and rifles or shotguns.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when I was a young child, once again, throughout high school, we would buy 22s and we would shoot 22s and we would buy compound bows and little child's bows and a lot of gear. But like I said, 5 years ago, I decided to get into the primitive technology and some of the natural items that our ancestors used to use. Not only in America, but our ancestors in Europe and throughout the world used to use.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I got into that and started seeing the importance of that is because anything can happen in the field. There can be, you know, an event of an earthquake or an economic collapse, or even we're lost out in the field on a hike, or we're just trying to teach, you know, to learn the land and test ourselves out in the environment. That's really where primitive skills comes in handy, because anything can happen. I can have a knife, but I can lose it. I can have a ferro rod, but I can lose that. Heck, even a compound bow, I can lose an arrow. I can lose that bow. So what do I do then? I have to learn how to craft something using what our Creator has to provide.
So once again, you're focusing on the skill, not the object, which is something you can always take with you and you basically don't lose. Would you say that your area where you live is that Kawiya Indian?
Well, yeah, the Morongo Basin, Morongo Valley, all the way through 29 Palms, we had three tribes. We had the Kawiya, we had Serrano, and we had Chemehuevi. Chemehuevi is a form of Paiute that actually traveled quite often. More Kawiya occupied Idyllwild and down into Palm Desert and Palm Springs and the Coachella Valley. That's predominantly where the Kaweah were, but they were into the Morongo Basin. So, you know, there was a, working at the Morongo Indian Reservation and learning from them as well as sharing my skills, you really understand how many American Indian tribes there really were. There were a lot of Indians that occupied tons of land. I mean, all throughout America. And
oh, this was all Indian territory, all of it.
Yeah. I mean, it is, and I think a lot of people forget of how many different tribes and how many Indian people were roaming this land far before us.
So you're picking up on the indigenous traditions going from, you know, using tools and exploring the outdoors and learning what the native people did. Did you find that there was a sufficient volume of reference material or people to talk to learn some of the skills that local people to you were practicing? Were there books? Were there people that you could go to? Tell us how you pursued the knowledge that you now have.
Yeah, sure. Well, the first thing is you, Christopher. You know, I've attended many of your classes, and the plant knowledge is tremendous. I mean, I'll never forget the first time I took a plant class. I was a little overwhelmed, but I learned how to identify plants and certain characteristics of plants. So I would say, you know, you, Christopher, huge inspiration and a huge wealth of knowledge.
But then, of course, you're in the desert, and we have a slightly different ecotype,
yeah.
So you must have had some local-to-you sources too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I went to the Desert Institute. That's through the Joshua Tree National Park Association. I've taken everything from pine needle basketry to archaeology classes, excuse me.
Were these taught through local colleges, or the basketry classes?
It's an accredited system, so it's through the national park, and they'll actually use accredited classes towards a degree. And I, you know what? To be honest with you, I didn't take it for a degree. I took it as I want to learn and I want to expand my knowledge. But it also reaches beyond the Desert Institute classes. Like I said, I've worked with Aaron Sobel, who's his grandmother was a Kaweah elder, and he's taught me a tremendous amount of skill and knowledge.
The grandmother was
Catherine Sobel.
Catherine Sobel, and if you're a Southwesterner and you know ethnobotany, she and Lowell Bean wrote the classic book Tamalpak, which I think means from the earth.
From the earth.
Yeah, that's a great book. Tell us about Aaron and your studies with him.
Sure. Yeah, Aaron's taught me a lot of the Kaweah traditions, and he's even shared with me some of the bird songs, and the bird songs are stories of the migration, and it's a really really important part of their culture and their heritage. He's taught me you know, food processing
you don't mean with a food processor from Walmart, right? What has he taught you?
No, not from Walmart. Using a mortar and pestle. Basically, for those of you who don't know what that is, what they would do is they would take a hard stone against a soft stone, and they would make something called a mortar. And a mortar is a man-made indentation into the rock, and it would be smooth and round, and they would actually use that to grind different seeds, acorn, mesquite, palo verde, so forth and so on.
You're doing a lot of grinding of seeds with desert foods, aren't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then,
You mentioned palo verde, and the big one is mesquite, I guess, right?
Yeah, mesquite was used predominantly out there.
How would you describe that to somebody who's never seen one, the mesquite bean in the plant?
Yeah, well, the mesquite, the first thing is it tastes a lot like coconut. It's one of my favorite plants besides the agave. But the plant, it's a very hard, dense wood. Some of the old Indian people would make sinew-backed bows out of mesquite wood because it's so hard. and it really does make a great bow. It has a long pod on it. It has a long yellow. Depending on the season. Early in the season, the pod will be a little bit green. It'll dangle from the plant, and then once that starts to mature, it'll start turning yellow. And once it turns yellow, that's when you gather it and you crush the entire pod up. I usually separate the seeds. You don't have to. You can pound down those seeds. They tend to be a little tough. And then you can either make a tea out of it. So we go to Walmart or some of the grocery stores and we see Crystal Light. Well, essentially, you can do the same thing with mesquite. Mesquite is not only edible, but it's also medicinal. A lot of the Indian tribes, the recent study has found that it actually helps control diabetes. So
really? Just by eating the beans?
Yeah, by processing it into a flour or making a tea out of it. As a matter of fact, there is some study that says it actually kills diabetes.
Huh.
So I don't have diabetes, but you know.
I consider the mesquite one of the tastiest desert foods. That's more or less ready to go. All you basically need to do is grind it down. Paul Campbell once gave me some. I guess it was like a sugar. It was ground into a flour, and you could eat it as is, or you can put it in water. It was just amazingly delicious. Just while we're on the topic of foods, what are some of the other native desert foods that you enjoy eating and teaching people about?
Yeah, well, some of the other ones, of course, acorns. And I learned that from you, Christopher. You know, I learned how to process acorns from you. Some of the common desert foods would be chia. Some of the medicines would...
Wait, chia?
Yeah,
like
chia.
A chia pet?
Yeah. It's a lot better though. You know, you buy chia seeds at Costco, and they really don't have much of a taste. And you would be absolutely surprised in how different they taste when gathering them in the wild. They have a sage taste.
Okay, let me add something to you. So you may not know this, Jeff, but it is a sage. It's a Salvia columbariae, mm-hmm. The desert chia. But the chia pet and the one you buy at the store is not the same plant.
It's not the same.
It's not the same. So if you plant those seeds, it'll look more like a sage or a mint. And it's because when the desert chia seed was popularized, the Mexican chia seed was cultivated, and they just sold that, and they used the same name. It's a close relative, and it's very good, but it's not the same. So you are right in your experience and your feeling that this native stuff, actually, you feel better.
Yeah.
It's a different seed. It's not the same one.
Yeah, you know, I've never bought a chia pet. So
I wouldn't have held it against you.
Yeah, that's right. So but you know, there's other native plants in the desert that I'll use. I'll use the Mojave yucca, or the scientific name Yucca sidigra. That's one of the most useful plants out in the desert. It has everything from soap making. You can make a soap out of it. You can make a rope out of it. You can eat you can eat parts of the plant.
Tell us which parts I'd like to know.
Yeah, I call it a four-part series. So the Mojave yucca, early in development, you'll see the heart starting to form. And what you can do is you can take that heart and you can actually roast it. So you would do a pit roast. A lot of the traditional Cahuilla Indians would do just that.
Now, are you saying the heart, or do you mean the young shoot that comes up?
Yeah, the young shoot.
Okay.
Yeah, I've always recognized it as the Mojave yucca heart.
Okay.
But yeah, the young shoot, so you'll start to see it form. When it's still closed, you can harvest that. You can do a pit roast and you can eat that. And then that'll start to open up and start to flower out. You can also pick those flowers and you can boil them down. That makes a great add to another food like rabbit or ground squirrel or, you know, something, even steak you'd buy at a store. It's quite tasty.
Right, all of the wild foods don't have to be added to ground squirrel.
Well, that's right.
It could be conventional foods that you just add it to.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of folks do just that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll buy steak in a grocery store and pick wild plants and add it as a seasoning.
No, I think some people think it's either or, like it's all wild foods or not, but I just add it to my diet on a regular basis. I don't try to eat all wild. So anyway, there's the the shoot of yucca, and what are the other foods that you get from the yucca?
So yeah, you have the shoot, you have the flower, and eventually, as the season continues to progress, you'll see a little fruit that's starting to shoot out the center of the flower as the flower starts to die, and as that starts to mature, you can harvest the fruit, and that's actually my favorite stage. You got to be careful with it. A lot of the plant books, except for the one Christopher has came up with, talk about eating the Mojave yucca fruit and yucca whiplii when it's real mature. And what I find is it tends to give you a stomachache because of the saponins. It's real heavy in saponins at that point. So what I like to do is I like to gather them while they're young, boil them down, and then roast them. That's my favorite stage. It tastes a lot like a sweet banana, or some people compare it to a yam. And after that, if you missed all three of those, you know, and I don't know where you've been, but if you miss all three stages and the fruit starts to dry out, you can actually harvest that, and you'll see a little black seed in the dry fruit, and you can pound that down to a flour. I don't find much of a taste, though.
I don't like it either.
Yeah.
But the native people apparently did use it, because I guess you used everything that you did, everything that you could find.
Definitely. They would, you know, they wouldn't harvest in one area. They would harvest for miles and miles and miles. And sometimes they would miss some of these native foods, like the Mojave yucca. So later on in the season, when they went out to harvest other plants, they would find those dry fruits, and they would have to use the seeds. I mean, nothing went to waste.
Yeah,
nothing went to waste.
I've heard the yucca called nature's hardware store. You really get a lot of stuff. And now there's the related century plant or agave.
Yeah.
Do you do much with the agave out in the desert?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I go down to the Malki Museum just about every single year.
Malki Museum is in what town?
That is in Morongo. So, that's
right off the 10 freeway, right?
Yes, that's right off the 10 freeway next to Cabazon. It's quite a unique museum, and like I said, that's where I really learn from the native people and share as well. But back to the agave, I go to an agave harvest and an agave roast, and what we'll do is we'll use a digging stick.
And that's sponsored by the museum, right?
Yeah,
the Malki
yeah.
Museum, okay.
Yep, the museum does hold that event. You take a digging stick and you actually remove the heart of the, I call it the heart, some folks call it the shoot, same thing. You harvest that shoot or the heart, and you actually let it roast in a pit, a traditional pit, for anywhere from 3 to 5 days.
So you do, like, on our dirt time this week, Chris Moraski was one of our instructors. He dug a pit, made a fire, put in some greens, put in some potatoes and onions and things, covered it back up and let it roast for several hours. That's what you do with the agave?
Well, the agave takes a little bit longer. It can take several days. I like to do a slow cook. So, you know, I'll check it every single day, make sure I got a nice hot bed of coals, and I like to do a slow cook. It tends to be a little bit more tender, and it tends to hold in a lot of the flavor. Those of you who have not had agave, it is, once again, along with mesquite, it is one of my favorite plants. It tastes like sweet potato. It's absolutely delicious. It's something to definitely try if you haven't before.
So I know that was one of the big foods from the agave. Are there any other things that you might use, or you know of having been used with the agave plant?
With the agave plant, to be honest, I don't know. I don't know of anything that was used with it. I'm sure there was meat if they had it.
Oh no, what I'm asking is, I didn't mean, did you add meat, or do you add a Big Mac or anything like that? I don't mean that. What I mean is other uses of the agave plant that you can speak of.
Oh, absolutely. Lots of uses. A lot of the traditional Indians, Cahuilla, Serrano, Chimoweve, and even throughout the West, they would make sandals out of it. It's a very fibrous plant. And another thing is more so for survival, if you get a cut, you can actually use that as a needle and thread. Or I don't recommend doing that. I don't recommend doing that because then you're risking infection. So we'll use, for example, a rip in your clothes. So if you brush against a mesquite tree, which do have thorns, and you get a tear in your pants, you can actually sew that up using the agave plant. There's a lot of uses.
Have you seen some of the guys here that have had either a yucca or an agave, I'm not sure, one of the dried stalks that they turned into quivers?
Oh, absolutely. That's you. Yeah.
Wasn't me. I do have a couple.
Yeah.
But somebody here, wasn't me, somebody here did have a quiver made out of the agave.
Yeah, that was...
Might have been Madison Parker, one of the instructors here.
Yeah.
So if you haven't seen it, when the plant dies and you haven't cut it down and you're eating it all, it sends up this tubular stalk. It could be even up to a foot in diameter at the base, and it gets old and it dries and it's very easily hollowed. They make great quivers.
Absolutely, yeah. They traditionally they would make a quiver out of it, and it does. So I do make traditional arrows, and I'll paint them with red ochre and yellow pigments and whatnot. And that's something you can definitely use. It's another option for the agave plant.
Now, Jeff, where did you learn your fire skills?
You know what? I actually learned the first bow drill fire. I actually went out and I watched YouTube video after YouTube video.
You really learned from YouTube?
You know what? I learned the basic principle of it, but I actually went out and I had to do it. That is the key.
That's what I want to hear. You have to do it.
Yeah. That is the key to this. You know, you don't watch YouTube. You don't even watch my videos, and you say you have learned a skill. You have to do it. You have to get out there and do it. And the bow drill, I went out there and I did it. And I failed and I failed and I failed over and over again. And then I remember I finally got an ember. And I was so excited, I kicked dirt on it. And guess what happened?
It went out. Yeah.
It went out. Yeah. It went out. So what did I do? I went ahead and I did it again. And I got an ember and I said, okay, I need to slow down. I need to calm down. And I put it in a tinder bundle and I blew it into flame. Now the hand drill,
Before you continue, how long did it take you the first time you succeeded?
Oh, geez. It probably took me... I think it was 2 or 3 days.
And how many times had you tried it after watching the various YouTube videos?
I tried it so much that my hands started to get stiff, and I couldn't hold that bow much longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you were determined. That's good. And then you went to the hand drill. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I went to the hand drill, and I actually learned it from a gentleman by the name of John Campbell. And
John Campbell, who lives out in your neck of the woods, am I mistaken?
No. He's actually in Arizona. He's in the Prescott area. And we gathered a bunch of bear grass and dried mullein stalks with saguaro ribs, and I could not do it. I failed over and over once again. But now, since I got the mechanics and I understand the science behind the hand drill, since then I've made about 200 to 300 fires. But
what wood do you prefer when you do the hand drill?
Yeah, I use my preferred material is California fan palm as the fireboard or the hearth, and mule fat. Mm-hmm. Both of them soft woods. The California fan palm, you can get an ember real fast. It's a nice soft fibrous wood. But one thing I want to add to that is even now, I was sharing with you earlier, Christopher. I have made, like I said, 200-300 fires easily with the hand drill. That's my preferred technique now. But I have failed even to this current day. One of the stories I'd like to share is something that I shared with Christopher earlier. Is I was out in the desert chaparral and I had a mule fat spindle, nice and dry. I had cottonwood bark, but I didn't have a hearth board, and I couldn't find any yucca, no yucca stalks out there, but we did have juniper. And I tried it with juniper, and I actually failed. So, you know, fire will...
How long did you work at it before you determined that it was a failure with that setup?
Until my hands started...
couldn't do it anymore, it sounds like.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, until the blisters started bleeding, and at that point I said, you know, fire humiliated me, you know.
What do you think the problem was? Because I have made fire with juniper, but it was very dry. Was it too green, or just... What was it, do you think?
It's a very hard wood.
Yeah, okay, it's a hard wood, right.
Yeah.
But I'd have to say, again, for those of you who have never seen this, maybe you haven't watched any of the corny TV shows, but the mule fat is a plant that grows in the Southwest. It's like a pencil size, about 18 inches, and you're spinning it vertically onto a flat piece of wood. And like Jeff was saying, one of the ideal hearths, it's called, that flat piece of wood, is California fan palm, which is our only native palm here in California. And do you use any part of the fan palm, or what part of the fan palm do you use?
Yeah, you don't want to use the frond. You don't want to use that. That tends to be a little bit hard, and you got the risk of injury with the spines on it. So what you want to do is you want to use the ribs. And
does everybody know what the ribs are? What is that?
If anybody drives down, you know, downtown LA, or they drive in Palm Springs, you'll see the fan palm, and you'll see these nasty shoots hanging off of it, and that's where the seeds like to grow, and eventually they will fall, or you know, just by natural winds. We get a lot of wind in the desert, and once they fall, you can actually open those up, and you can open the husk. And you'll see a rib, a solid rib that goes right through the center of that husk. And it actually is so unique, because you can use that husk for a tinder bundle, but the top of the rib up facing you, the wide part is on the bottom, the thin part is up towards your face, that it grows in joints. So that first part is excellent for a bow drill spindle. It's a real soft wood. Then that midsection, below the first joint, is great for a hand drill spindle. And then below that, where it starts curving and it gets a little bit harder towards the end in the stock of it, that's great for a bow drill hearth.
Yeah. So the people of the desert did all kind of stuff with the palm tree. It was an excellent tree to have.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of native stories regarding, you know, the palm tree with different tribes.
Yeah.
So it did. It definitely is a useful plant. And one of the other things that I want to throw out there with California fan palm is finding water in the desert is extremely difficult, especially in Joshua Tree and the Mojave. There are some areas that I'll go into and you can't find water. It's just not there. But a lot of the books will tell you, look for cottonwood trees, look for willow, look for mule fat. I want to point out California fan palm. If you find a group of California fan palm, there is water nearby. In the middle of the desert, absolutely.
Even if you have to dig for it, though, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's usually you'll find it at the surface.
Yeah.
That's what I've always noticed about the
village encampments are always around where you found the native palms. And before we run out of time, we've got about a little more than 2 minutes left. I want you to tell us about your videos. You have a whole series of YouTube videos. It's on Martin Survival, it's called. Is that how people will find you on YouTube?
Yeah, type in youtube.com/Martin Survival or just search box Martin Survival.
And how did you start that? You film them yourself, or do you have somebody film them?
Yeah, you know what? I started them real camera shy and reviewing gear, because that's what I was taught at a young age. You know, rely on your gear. And now you start seeing the primitive skills come into place. You know, shooting bows, making quivers, making arrows. Currently, I think I have around 11,000 subscribers, well over 300,000 video views.
That's a lot. That's a lot. Yeah. How often do you post new YouTube videos?
Well, I'll tell you, they're starting to slow down, and they're starting to slow down because how time consuming they are. When I go out into the field, I like experiencing nature and really being one with nature, not having to worry about a camera. And that's how I continue to grow and develop.
But you have a lot of the educational videos out there, don't you?
Yes, yeah.
So
yeah.
People can tune into your station and watch them at their leisure. What do you have, a couple hundred out there?
Oh, I have well over 500 videos.
That's really remarkable, 500 YouTube videos. And do you have any books or any other projects in mind that you're projecting doing?
No books. No books yet. I am going to appear on National Geographic. I'm not holding my breath on that.
What show?
It's National Geographic Doomsday Preppers.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Okay, well, so, I wish you the best on that one.
Yeah, we'll see how it is. I did it more for publicity.
Well, I hope it works well. Well, look, we're out of time. I really appreciate you spending this time at Dirt Time 2014. Tell us how we can reach you again.
Sure. Reach me at martinsurvival.com. That's MartinSurvival.com.
And that's your website. And you can also go to YouTube. Thank you very much, Jeff.
All right. Take care. Thank you.